welcome.
Hi.
To the Completely Unnecessary Podcast, number 335? Fives and zeros.
Crazy.
We're in the fall now, officially. Fall is fallen. Tuesday. Why are you yawning right in the beginning?
Doesn't matter.
September 27th. You have all the time in the world to yawn. 2022. That's yawning Ian Ferguson, the yawning Triceratops Ian Ferguson.
That's me.
You need a t-shirt of that, yawning Triceratops. I'm Pat Contry. We're actually wearing the Into the AM shirts.
That's right.
Use code Contry, C-O-N-T-R-I, to save on these nice graphic tees. On the show today, we'll be talking about certain game auctions coming up from a specific individual. We're talking about Consumer Reports gaming chairs a little bit.
That's right.
It's fun. And we'll also be doing a Patreon poll, listening to your voice messages, and we discuss space and how awesome technology is on the exclusive patreon.com/CU podcast. Nothing Matters Podcast. That's the name of it. Almost forgot. We talked about how, like, you could see Jupiter clear as day. Not clear as day, but pretty clear yesterday. And NASA crashed on purpose a satellite into an asteroid millions of miles away from the planet, which is incredible.
We also discovered what the bedtimes are for space campers.
Yes, we wish it was 1986 again here. Mm-hmm. On the CU podcast with just space ice cream. It was all. You don't want to miss it.
Be sure to check it out.
What else happened there? I watched the Predator over the weekend. That was a mistake. The Predator came out in 2018. Not Predator 1987. The Predator.
Right.
2018. Written and directed by Shane Black, who was Hawkins in the original Predator. Young Hawkins.
Oh, that's right.
So the story was, because Shane Black has written and directed a lot of things. He wrote Lethal Weapon. He's written Kiss. He wrote and directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He wrote and directed Iron Man 3, which most people love. He wrote and directed Nice Guys, which is amazing. If you haven't seen Nice Guys, go watch Nice. It's on Netflix. So he's written a lot of things. Last Boy Scout, people like that one, the Bruce Willis one.
And never saw that one.
Supposed to be good. So he's been a prolific writer, usually on the action side, action with humor stuff. So the story was for Predator 87, they hired him. They said, oh, you're going to act in it and you can help us punch up the script while you're here. And I think the story was basically, he's like, well, I don't want to do double duty. I'm not going to be writing it as I'm in the fucking jungle here. I'm going to be acting.
Yeah.
But that's why they got him on to do it. So I'm sure he punched it up here and there. So that's what he's known for. So, but then he wrote and directed The Predator 2018. That was a bad movie. And I've never seen Alien vs. Predator 2, which is supposed to be bad.
It's supposed to be miserable.
And I've never seen most of the first Alien vs. Predator, which I think is supposed to be kind of eh.
The first Alien vs. Predator, my problem with it is it's actually, like, it follows the comic pretty well. It uses some ideas. Uh-huh. It's a good story. Like, it's a good framing for it. Mm-hmm. It was released in that time where all, like, between, like, live action and CG, where, like, all of the, like, fights and action were quick cuts and you never really saw anything.
Oh, God.
Like, you never really, like, that was my problem with it. You didn't really see the action.
Sure. So, and then I saw some of Predators, which was pretty good, where they take the humans back to the Predator planet.
Little by the books, but it was fine.
It was fine. This is not fine, this movie. And I think I had it DVR'd. YouTube TV, it's in the cloud, whatever, DVR. I decided to check it out because it's like, is it even 2 hours? 107 minutes. It moves along.
It's billed as a science fiction action horror comedy.
There's comedic elements.
On the Wikipedia, at least, because I've never seen this, so I'm just following along.
I almost wanted to have this conversation after you saw it. Maybe I can.
I'm not going to see it.
so the cast is amazing for this movie. The cast includes people like Sterling K. Brown. You have Thomas Jane in it. You have Keegan-Michael Key in it, for example.
So there's good. Yeah, those are good people.
Yes. Yes. They're used like garbage in it. The characters are terrible. But so here's the premise of The Predator. The premise of The Predator is you figure out it starts with like a space battle between, you realize it's two Predator ships from their homeworlds, and one escapes and comes to Earth. Which ends up being like the one on the run, you figure out. There's two Predators in this movie. There's a regular Predator and there's a giant Predator. Like, it's like as big as the one in Prey. But I don't know if it's that species or something else. It sounds like it's something weird was going on with that. So the Predator crash lands, and then Boyd Holbrook's character, you would know who Boyd Holbrook is when you see him. He's like, I don't want to call anyone generic, but he's like the blonde action guy they get in some of these movies. He's the star of this. He's a sniper in the movie, and then it crash lands, and then he gets some technology back in his backpack, and of course Sterling K. Brown is just he's the evil government guy who's evil just to be evil, but he's always like chewing gum for some reason, and he has no regard for human life, so if you get in his way, he's going to kill you. So Sterling K. Brown wants to get back this Predator tech because they find the body. And this is the one that has Olivia Munn in it. And this was Olivia Munn. There was some weird stuff that happened.
Reading about it. There was like a small role from one of Shane Black's friends that was a convicted sex offender.
A registered felony
sex offender since 2010.
Yeah. And Olivia Munn spoke out about it. And so the part was cut. It sounded like it was a meaningless cut anyway. Olivia Munn's character in this movie, all the characters like don't belong in the movie. That's the problem. So now going to the other ones, but I'll start with Olivia Munn. Olivia Munn plays a biologist that is brought on to examine the Predator body at a government facility. The reason she's brought on, I'm not even making this up. She's known as a biologist, and Sterling K, who's evil still, but like inviting her in to look at an alien body, which by the way, is strapped on a gurney, Ian, with no real restraints. It's just like leathery. It's not like in like a cage. It's not in like an aluminum shell. It's sedated. It's alive and sedated, and it's just strapped down. So they go into decontamination before they can see the body, but they're not wearing any facial protection or breathing apparatus around an alien body. It's insane, but they have the rest of the hazmat suit on. Okay, the one redeeming thing about this movie, Jake Busey is in it, playing the son of Gary Busey's character from Predator 2.
Oh, okay.
It's the same last name, but he's only in the movie for 5 minutes, so it doesn't matter at the government facility. But it's a cool little tag on there. So Olivia Munn is brought on to examine the body, but does nothing. And the reason she's there in the story is that, well, I wrote a letter to the president when I was 6 years old saying I love science, and now I'm a biologist, and they cross-referenced my name, and that's why I was the chosen biologist to come look at the body. That was why they sought her out to come look at a fucking alien body that the government has. Like, that was literally in the movie, and it wasn't like a wink. They know it makes no sense. So, of course, the Predator is no longer sedated all of a sudden and literally just undoes the straps and kills everyone. Probably the best part of the movie. Kills all the scientists. At the same time this is happening, you can't make how bad this is. At the same time this is happening, right outside this government facility, which should be fucking locked down worse than anything, like NORAD, but it's not. It looks like some just regular building somewhere, some biotech building. A bus with a bunch of bad acting soldiers that either have PTSD or shot their CO are on a bus, this ragtag group, including Thomas Jane and Keegan-Michael Key. They're on a bus outside this facility being transported to group therapy for some reason. Not making this up. At the same facility where they have an alien body. And of course, the Predator escapes. And then those guys decide, hey, we should hunt down the Predator. And when I'm watching this movie, I can't tell, is this supposed to be a comedy the whole time? Am I supposed to be taking this whole thing seriously? Thomas Jane has Tourette's for no reason. Then he doesn't have Tourette's later in the movie, his character. Everything's played for a weird joke. The tone is all over the fucking map.
Yeah,
and
sounds like it.
It's just a very, very stupid script.
Yeah.
I'm not even getting into the action, but it's so, I don't know what to say. Shane Black just swung and missed, and you know, he's usually a really good writer, and this was not it.
Looks like there's quite a bit of talk about there being problematic representations of autism in the film.
Okay.
We're going to have to move on here, but okay.
But real quick,
can't hang up on this.
The autistic child, which goes from being like not being able to communicate to a regular kid, it like swings back and forth during the movie. Doesn't make any sense.
He's a regular kid.
What's that?
He's a regular.
I mean, in terms of like the acting, he goes from not being able to communicate. All of a sudden, he's communicating.
He's like, yeah.
But he figured out the Predator language because he's autistic, right? That he does in the movie. He figures out the Predator language through the mask. He's doing all these manipulations. He gets the mask from his father, the sniper. It's ridiculous. One of the worst parts of the movie is that there's two bullies. that call him Asperger, because I guess he's supposed to have Asperger's. They call him Asperger. He walks around later in the movie. The same bullies that hassle him at school come back later, and the kid is wearing the Predator mask, and he has the gauntlet on, which gives him powers. He gets recognized by the bullies when he has a fucking full mask on covering him. And at that point, I'm like, I'm done. That was like 40 minutes into the movie. I'm like, I'm done. I'm fucking done with this movie. But I had to see it through. Some of the action's decent. There's two different Predators, which is, for a time, there's two different Predators. Spoilers, the one kills the other. And the ending, okay, I'll give away the ending. The ending is this. The Predator came to Earth to give us the special anti-Predator weapon. I'm not making this up. The anti-Predator weapon's revealed at the end as, like, it attaches yourself. You basically become Iron Man. It's an Iron Man Predator armor that a human could wear.
A piece of technology floats out and attaches itself to a lab worker working as a transformative Predator killer suit before deactivating, realizing the first Predator was trying to pass it on to humanity for a fair fight against the larger Predators. McKenna indicates he will be the pilot to operate the suit.
It's awful.
Well, I'm so glad that this did not continue.
This was supposed to be a trilogy, and it didn't continue.
Yeah, that sounds terrible. Absolutely miserable.
It was miserable. Now we're going to move on. What else is going on?
Oh, boy. Well, my weekend, that was long. So my weekend was fun. I just played Splatoon 3 for most of the weekend. Really enjoyed it. Getting better at it. It's fun to play something online and competitive again and go shoot people with paint.
There you go.
So that was basically that. There's a Consumer Reports report on gaming chairs.
Consumer Reports report?
Consumer Reports report.
Or Consumer Report.
Consumer Report report.
Okay.
However you want to look at it. And they went through a bunch of gaming chairs and reviewed them. And it's interesting because I think the intro kind of talks about, how bucket seats are not... bucket seats are not ideal for gaming chairs. They exist to keep race car drivers from flying out of their seats on turns.
So the race car style like this over to my left.
Yeah, there's absolutely no reason for it for that to
be like in
a thing. It's just to look cool. So they note that a lot of this is just, how cool can we make stuff look? But they did say that there were two that they really recommended, the Herman Miller Embody, which is $1,800, and the Cooler Master Ergo L, which is $445.
So they're saying that's worth it for $400. By the way, this is from Nicholas De Leon here, Best Gaming Chairs article. Some of it is free, but obviously Consumer Reports has no advertising. That's why they're the go-to source for Consumer Reports on products, because they accept zero advertising.
Yeah. So they go through and they rate a few. Right. And these ones, I think, are the ones that they rated a little bit more highly, because they're 5 out of 5s and 4 out of 5s for a lot of things. Like the Herman Miller is all 5s except for ease of use, which is 4. Ease of use would be, like, I guess, the reclining and lowering.
Yeah, tilt back.
Yeah. And then the Cooler Master Ego was mostly 4 out of 5s, except for the ergonomic design was 5 out of 5. And then a lot of them, they go down from there, but they don't list anything. Nothing is lower than a 3 out of 5 on anything except for the G-Tracing gaming chair with a comfort level of 3.5. So anyways, Consumer Reports is great. My favorite magazine as a child was not Nintendo Power. It was Zillions. The Consumer Reports magazine for kids, where they actually got kids and, like, they took all the cool toys for the year.
I don't remember
and
that.
And they actually had kids, like, review them and stress test them and write the reviews. And, yeah, it was an awesome magazine. It stopped in 2000, when print media started to die. Consumer Reports, always good to look at. And I just like that this article justified what I've always said. So many of these just look cool, but they're not comfortable to sit in.
Well, is there a TLDR that... If you eyeball it, that is there any correlation between the pricier it is, the more comfortable it is, or is it all over the map?
It's all over the map.
That's why
it's all over the map. That's why they the one that got, I think, the worst rating, I think, is only like $180. But like I said, when they announced and Consumer Reports is good about doing this with most things, they give you a price range. They're like, if you've got the money, this is a good one to get. Sure. And if you've got less money, this $450 one is better too. That's why I like them.
I think this chair is really comfortable that we're sitting in right now.
I don't like this chair. You and I are different. And okay. I think a lot of it comes down to personnel, like, or personal preference, you know?
But the point is that like this chair is not super, super expensive. I think these chairs were under 100 each. I think they're under 100.
Under 100?
I think they were about under 100.
Okay.
Why?
That seems incredibly cheap to me.
Maybe it was a deal. Maybe nowadays it'd be more money. I bought these like 5 years ago. Maybe they were 100. But the point is that like that one, this one to my left here, this has all the bells and whistles. I think this was 150 here. But I don't think the quality of this would be that much worse than one that costs $300 or $350 for what you get. I just think a lot of these chairs, the marketing's built into some of these. And I don't think a lot of these are that much different for the price. I guess that's my point.
Sure.
Maybe these were like 120 each. Maybe something like that.
Maybe.
I'm sorry if it's uncomfortable. Should I get an extra pillow for you? I think these are perfect. The reason I don't use this for that is because this doesn't have a full headrest. And I like this has a full headrest on the left.
Headrest is nice. And then I think I don't like this lump here. I think that's my big...
Lump? You mean the curve?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's my big takeaway is I'm just not huge on that lower lumbar lump. And I never have been.
I like the lumbar
Never
support.
Have been.
I'm a lumbar support guy. I like my lumbar support.
I probably should like it, but...
I was going to say, yeah. I don't know what the shape of your spinal cord is. But
it's awful. It's a miserable shape.
Okay. Disney wants to do two Star Wars games per year, not just two games. Disney wants to do two Star Wars games per year. That's the new report. They'll be pushing for one AAA game, one smaller game every fiscal year going forward.
I think it's a bad idea to lock yourself into something and say that. I mean, I don't know why you would say that because now you put the pressure on yourself to do what you said. And I mean, when things are scheduled like that, obviously quality goes out the window because it's ship or shit. Shit or ship. Shit or get off the pot.
Yeah, I don't mind doing like a smaller, medium sized game every year because you can do like a smaller budget game. That's an interesting
I think the smaller games would that would actually be kind of cool.
Or
but,
do like a go back to, I don't know, there hasn't been a when's the last time we had a real-time strategy Star Wars game or turn-based one? How far back was that? You know, something like that, like the ones from the late 90s or 2000s. So I don't mind doing that or going back to the combat sims. You know, we just had the X-Wing Squadrons come back, but, you know, you can do a new updated TIE fighter every probably three, 4 years. So I can understand working that into the rotation, but I don't think we can support a new fucking Jedi game every year.
We can't support a new AAA game every year. I mean, just look at what happens with everything else. The quality decreases.
Sure. I mean, and they already canceled. I guess they're going to restart the Knights of the Republic remake that they're going full steam ahead and they put it on, was it indefinite hold? I don't know. Would that count as one? Is that a medium sized one? I don't know.
Star Wars Galactic Battlegrounds. I can never remember the name of the RTS. Yeah.
So, Insider Gaming reports that Lucasfilm is on board from the plan. This is from Steve Watts at GameSpot reporting. These include Jedi Survivor, great, another Jedi. Star Wars Eclipse from Quantic Dream, the competitive shooter Star Wars Hunters, and untitled games from a few other companies, including Ubisoft. So we have, they farm out a bunch of different, several studios are working on these. I mean, I think that's fine. I just don't know if there's a mass market for a AAA game every single year like that.
I think there is. I mean, the Star Wars fandom is massive. You set yourself up for failure when you say shit like that. That's all
I guess you could say we haven't seen that since the 90s, but when you did it in the 90s, they were entirely different games coming out all the time.
Sure.
You had combat sims, you had Dark Forces, you had your first person shooter, you have your strategy, the game we talked about. So you had all these different things that were going on at the same time. And you had even stuff like the arcadey type of games like Rebel Assault on the side, all different things happening. But the quality of all those games were really high. There wasn't really a Star Wars like stinker that came out then where it was like, oh, this game was just fucking terrible. Even the ones that weren't as good was like, these are
Masters of Terrace Kasi.
I'm not counting that. I think more the computer stuff. I'm not counting that.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I'm not talking about like some weird fucking, what was that, just on PlayStation? Not talking about that. But
I don't think that was on PC. I think it was PlayStation only.
Yeah, I'm talking about more where like at the same time they were doing Dark Forces, Dark Forces 2, TIE Fighter. They were doing, you know, the Rebel Assault games. They were doing all these like bangers one after another. That's what I'm more talking about. Anyway, so I guess we'll see what happens with that. If you love your Star Wars, you can get two games every year. What else is going on here? Speaking of gaming, a popular YouTuber named Donkey, not Donkey. Donkey starting their own game company. This is a YouTuber that has millions of subscribers.
Yeah,
Content creator says he wants to use his reach to help bring the best indie games to market. They're launching a game publisher. I'm sick of sitting on the sidelines. Popular content creator Jason Gastro, better known as Video Game Donkey or just Donkey, has announced he's launching a game publisher called Big Mode. Speaking in an announced video, Gastro said, this comes from Video Games Chronicle, Tom Ivan. Speaking in an announced video, Gastro said he was sick of watching from the sidelines and believes he'll be able to use his reach and experience critiquing video games to help bring promising indie titles to market. However, many industry pundits and developers have questioned his qualifications for running a game development company. Okay, so I think that's the question. Is he developing from the ground up, or is he just going to be a publisher? Because those are two entirely different things.
Well, no, it's publishing, and I think that they're that's what it says, not developing. And I think the concerns are still hold. I just dropped an article that I looked up that's pretty good by Stacey Hunley on The Gamer. And I mean, the concerns are pretty big. You know, it seems like one of those things where, I don't want to say drunk on power, but you get popular, you get surrounded by yes men, and no one asks you, what are your qualifications? And he says, you know, well, I've championed a lot of these games, you know, but it's always the games after they come out.
Sure.
The publishing's been taken care of. Now you've got to really get into the nitty gritty and find the seeds that are worth developing. And that's a completely different thing than being able to look at popular indie games that have already been reviewed and, you know, pushing them to a greater light.
No, I get it. But I just want to make it clear that if he's, you know, going to be helping develop games from the ground up, that's a much different task than getting a game that's semi-completed or closer to completion and helping it push it to the finish line.
Well, I don't think he's doing any developing. It's just publishing.
Okay.
That's what it says.
Okay. So if he's going to help publish stuff, I guess I'd have to see him fail before I really kill him for trying. I'm not saying he's going to be awesome at it, but I want to see what he's going to do. Because he can throw money at something and then have a team of people finish something and not get directly involved. And that's still technically publishing. You can do that. It's just the guidance of putting the people nudging him in the right direction. So that's important, I think, to delineate on that. But no, there's no guarantee just because he gets involved it's going to be a hit. Absolutely not.
Right.
He doesn't have the knowledge to do it just because you played a lot of games. It's really simple to identify good and bad games. It's almost
Especially after they're out. Yes.
Yes.
It's not a magic skill.
No, it's not. It's not. You're not taking old ass games off. Like, it's almost be like if he was going to go back and find games that were already released, find like some sort of like quote unquote hidden gems, and then help them get marketing, get them to be known. That could be something that already fully finished and maybe quote unquote republished. That could be something. I don't know. But
then you're doing a limited run sort of thing.
Well, I just mean throw money and attention behind something because that's really what he's doing. When this is a guy that he can go to any small company and say, "Hey, I got millions of followers. I play your game. A ton of people are going to know about it." So the marketing is baked in because he's a big influencer. Then it's just okay. Well, what else are you going to do logistically to help this game get out? What are you going to do? What sort of support are you going to get? You know, do you have? Any other access to people to help? I got a t-shirt stuck underneath me. I'm sorry. Here, it's bothering me. So that's the thing. So you see this being more of a disaster than me?
I just will have to wait and see. But
you're more bearish on it. I'm more like neutral. I'm like, he might fuck up. He might do something. We'll see. Let's put it this way, though. After that, I'll just say this. The announcement video was a little pretentious.
Yes.
I will say that. And I would honestly, I don't see the advantage of announcing it. Like, why not just do it and say, hey, this game's coming out and I'm publishing it?
Because it's all about attention.
Okay, well, that's the argument. That's what you mean. But that's the thing. If I was doing that, I would not be like, oh, this is the next big thing coming. But all these, like, fucking, what's his name? Dr. Films
Dr.
Kids.
Dr. Douchebag.
Dr. Films Kids in Bathrooms. You know, he has this big game coming out. It's the biggest thing ever. And we see the first footage and it's hot garbage so far.
Right.
So. What else is going on here?
50th anniversary of the Magnavox Odyssey.
A 5 and a 0.
A 5 and a 0. That's a big one that we did not really cover.
Yeah.
They're doing a really nice... what's the word I'm looking for? They're doing a nice... It's not a display.
Mm-hmm.
The fuck is... What am I trying to say?
Exhibit.
Exhibit. Thank you. Jesus fucking Christ. My brain.
I think it's in the URL. Exhibitions. It's there.
Oh, shut up. It is. An exhibit. They're doing a really nice exhibit at the Chicago Game Space, which is something I honestly didn't know about until we got this. We got this article, and honestly, it sounds pretty fucking cool. The Chicago Game Space. I would go visit.
Yeah, I googled it, and I was like, I googled Odyssey 50th anniversary, and this came up. So this is running till October 16th at the Chicago Game Space. Anyone in Chicago ever going here? It's another video game museum that we didn't know about.
So it'll have an original Odyssey and all the game components. From the Game Space collection, a brief video interview with Odyssey inventor Ralph Baer, and gameplay documentation, and Baer's 1966 patent design for a device to play video games on television. I think it would be a cool exhibit to go see, especially because with Odysseys, you rarely have all the components and shit with it. The overlays and things like that. So it'd be nice to see that stuff.
You need the overlays.
They look like they're in really good shape.
Do they have the shooting gallery there? I mean, they don't want to show like a realistic looking rifle there.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see that.
Because to me, that's the coolest thing, having the light gun thing on it.
Right.
You know, early was that the first light gun? It must have been one of them. That must have came out like a year after, like 73 or so, the shooting rifle. There was a link I found that Frank Cifaldi tweeted out about going more into the back history of Ralph and his assistants putting together the ideas and the sketchings and the ideas of what this was going to be functionally. It was an interesting article. I wanted to comment in a little bit, but I don't have access to the link. But it was interesting because there was some speculation in the article about what Ralph did versus the assistants, about the ideas that maybe, you know, Ralph was the tech guy, but maybe he didn't have all the ideas about what a game could actually look like. And that's what the assistants sort of maybe helped nudge him about what can you actually do? Think about this. If you have no idea what a video game is, trying to think about what it can do on a screen, manipulating, you know, pixels and what you can do.
Right.
So that's basically what they were doing for years, trying to figure this out. But Ralph came up with that, with the good old RF technology, to basically interfere with the signal to have the signal override the TV from the console.
Right.
That was the big deal. That's what was the patent. That's what he still, I think, was getting paid out through like, I guess, until the 80s somehow, because like that was the technology that was like the game changer. It was like, we're going to have something interface with a TV from another object. Like, that's a giant part of it, obviously. And then, obviously, you get into manipulating stuff on screen. And that's all the conversation with that. But, yay, Odyssey. Woo! It's always an Odyssey at UltimateNintendo.com. It's always an Odyssey. You're going to encounter lots of things in your path to get through, like enamel pins, RBI baseball stickers, the limited T-shirts on sale for $10 each. We got the certain NES and NES, NES and Super Nintendo guidebooks and more, and stickers at UltimateNintendo.com. You can get your Danny approved.
Danny.
The CU podcast stickers, the limited stickers on there, and then Pat and Frank stickers are there too. I'll be on Twitch Wednesday night. Always a day after we record the podcast, twitch.tv/contrycode. And then we'll be at the Portland
Retro Gaming Expo. So soon. I'm very, very excited.
What's the dates on that, Ian? October
14th, 15th, and 16th.
Well, Friday we'll be setting up. But
oh, well, no, Friday is the arcade day.
Oh, but we'll be there the 15th and 16th.
Yes, I mean, we'll be there. But yeah. I mean, the whole event starts on Friday with the arcade stuff.
Absolutely. And then I'm on Cameo, cameo.com/PatContry. I check it every once in a while because sometimes I don't look to see what's going on there. But those are far less than what they used to be. Unfortunately for Pat, you don't want to get a Cameo anymore from me.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Anyway, we have another Web3 console in the works.
Another one. So you remember us talking about the Pulium a few months back, and they're still plugging away online saying that they're going to have this console ready. Well, this one is called the Zalika console. This is coming from VentureBeat. And Jason McMaster, blockchain company Zelika is announcing the launch of its Web3-based console, featuring first-party games from Zelika, a Web3 wallet and mining utilities. The console is designed for the crypto-minded. The overall goal of the device is to enable players to play games while mining Zil tokens. I mean, just that paragraph, you read it, and it's like, it's a job. They're not like... It just makes them money and maybe you a small amount of money, but it's all going to crash and burn anyways. I will say this. I don't think...
The Zil token? What is it? The Zil token? What is
Zil tokens. Yeah, well, mining Zil tokens.
So that'll be built in, baked into the experience of the games, I guess, some way.
Well, yeah, that's all blockchain crypto gaming. It's all earning money. It's not a fucking game. It's a job. There's always going to be one best way to do it, and you're just going to do that over and over again and make your money. It's not fucking gaming. It's a job.
Or you become the pit boss of other people to do the work for you.
Right.
I got the land. I'm leasing you in the land to farm your own shit that you turn into this token that can be turned into money. And hopefully the fucking token doesn't crash because the ecosystem will crash as soon as the token value drops. And that's what happens with all these.
Apparently, the gaming hub will enter its early access beta testing in October. So, in just a week or so,
they got a console. At least they got a prototype. Yeah. I mean, they got that far. This is a real like blockchain company. They work on other shit.
Right. This does look like that's not a render. I don't think that looks like a real deal console, which is one step further than Polium, but it is still to be ridiculed and laughed at.
You said that like a news source. It's still to be ridiculed. Laughed at. Now weather with Pam with weather.
Yeah, now Pam with the weather.
They're launching with two Zelika.
Holy shit.
Zelika games. Why do all these console names are diseases?
Yeah.
Zelika and Polium. Like, why are these all like exotic
Sounds
diseases?
Like things that we've had vaccines for.
Yes. What's happening here? They're gonna pre-order in quarter one of 2023. About 2 years too late, but hey. What are you going to do? Even a year too late.
Yeah.
We'll just say the first quarter of this year was the last hurrah for NFTs probably, right? About 6 months ago.
Yeah.
The people were like...
You don't forget Starbucks is going to get people interested in them again.
Yes, absolutely.
Fucking Christ.
We have an update. Uh-oh.
We do.
Also tonight, an update.
So the GTA 6 hacker was arrested. It was a 17-year-old in London.
Yeah. Crazy.
London police say the teenager was arrested as part of an investigation by the UK's cyber crime unit. Zach Zuisen reports from Kotaku on this. They announced that they arrested a 17-year-old from Oxfordshire Thursday morning. While the police have yet to confirm why, it's been reported that the teen was arrested in connection with the recent Uber and GTA 6 leaks. I'm not familiar with what the Uber leaks were. I'll look that up. Looked it up.
Uber yeah, I'm leaks. Not. I'm not certain what that is either. But I remember hearing about it only because they mentioned it when the story broke. Because the hacker was actually at 17, not smart enough to not be like, I did the Uber leaks as well. Like no. they took credit for it.
So it looked like it was a bunch of confidential files that were pulled. That said, like Uber broke laws, duped police, and secretly lobbied governments. The leak reveals 124,000. Confidential documents were leaked.
Holy shit.
So a treasure trove this person got. This teen? I guess it's the same person? The same kid?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was that, and this is this. The leaked documents pulled back the curtain on the methods Uber used to lay the foundations for its empire. There's a whole series about that, which was in Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
That came out about the Uber founder, like trying to, you know, like going after cities and making sure that everything was cool. You know, things like that. Greasing the wheels and things, you know, things of that nature. It's a whole empire. So, all right. So he'll do some prison time. Then maybe they'll white hat him. They'll get him on board to cybersecurity.
Yeah, I mean hopefully try to turn that kid's life around.
But he's gonna do some time.
There's some E3 bullshit. Oh yeah, he's definitely gonna do something.
Yeah,
some E3 bullshit. This is just I hate this. I hate this. E3 is coming back in 2023. The gaming industry event looks to rekindle its old in-person magic June 13th through 16th.
Oh, boy.
That's what it says. This is from CNET. Sean Keen reporting on this. And they said that they want to reunite the gaming industry. Just like the most stupid, fluffy, nothing words. What does reunite the gaming industry mean? They are bringing back the separate days. They're bringing back press only days. That will run from, what'd they say? So industry people and media, Sunday, June 11th is when it kicks off. E3 business days are for industry, media, and people. Those will happen Tuesday, June 13th to Thursday, June 15th. The business and media elements will be in separate parts. Members of the public will be able to have their public tickets June 15th and Friday, June 16th. And all I have to say about this is I just don't think this is going to work. Reunite the games industry means fucking nothing in a world with the internet. And... once again, we have just outgrown the use for something like E3. Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo all do their own events.
Ubisoft
all do their own events EA. With their own announcements. And, you know, that's the most important stuff is really the console, the manufacturers detailing what's coming to their consoles. We don't need these big Ubisoft showcases anymore. We also don't have the need for this to happen, as we've talked about many times. There's no reason for this to happen at one specific time of the year just because. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the business realities of the past where you want to push this shit in June so you can have it on the shelves by Christmas. You know, there was a marketing reason there, too. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to get all this news out and have all your stuff ready for the holiday season. But anyone can do those announcements at any time. Nintendo was honestly one of the first companies to really realize how pointless E3 was years and years and years ago when they stopped doing,
presentation. The Nokia Theater presentation.
Yeah, they stopped doing the presentation.
The one where I saw the Wii U announced in 2012.
They don't need to do it. The directs handle everything.
I went to how many E3s in a row? 3 or 4 for Retroware. I went to 11, I went to 12, and I think I went to 13. Yeah, I went to 3 in a row. Do you feel special going to E3? I'm thinking 12 years ago. Do you feel special? You feel like it's cool to go back then. This is 12 years ago.
It was much cooler. Like in the late 90s and throughout the 2000s, that was where people wanted to be. Everyone wanted to win a ticket to go to E3.
This is the first time, we sampled the Wii U before it came out.
Right.
That was cool. A very rudimentary Wii U. Very rudimentary. It was like tech demo stuff, but I was like, we're figuring this stuff out. But you're still dealing with massive lines. Like, I mean, it's a 4 day event, E3, right? Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It was 4 or 5 days sometimes. I think it was 5 days. Oh, no, excuse me. It's like Tuesday to like Friday or Saturday. It's not to Sunday. It's like it goes to like Saturday or whatever.
It's going to be 6 days next year.
Well, that's insane, first of all.
I thought that was the normal. I thought it started on Sunday and ended on Friday. I thought that's how it.
Well, usually they'd have just the first day or two was just like they used to have the theater events. Then they'd open the floor up, I thought, after that. But anyway, so the floor would be open for like 3 days. We would only check out the big booths on the last day because by then a lot of the people left. They already saw this shit. Because otherwise, you'd be waiting for 4 hours to try something. You'd be waiting for hours.
Right.
Some of the stuff, like I remember the Alien versus Predator game that came out around 2013 or whatever, the multiplayer one.
That rough one. I think that was a little bit earlier.
But we played against the devs and got our asses kicked. It was Space Marines versus the Aliens, whatever the hell it was. So that was cool. That wasn't waiting more than like 45 minutes. But if you wanted to play like the Wii U stuff, or if you wanted to play whatever the latest big, not like the big title stuff for like Sony on the first days, you're waiting hours. You're waiting hours. You're just sitting there. And when it was media only, I guess it wasn't a big of a deal. But I guess there were some people that wouldn't mind spending hundreds of dollars to wait hours to sample something for 5 minutes. But that's what it is. I just think, I don't know. It wasn't as big as what, it was cool to go. I'm not saying it was shitty. I'm not trying to be all hipster about it. It wasn't uncool, but I think
people can enjoy it. I mean, I never went because I hate fucking crowds. I had the chance to go like every year I worked at Luna, but I didn't feel the need to do it.
Well, that's the thing. And not that I want to get, you know, COVID deniers in the comments or whatever, but like, we're still in a pandemic. Like, we still have multiple thousands of people dying every year in the U.S. from this shit. I think it's like 3,000 or 3,500 every week that are still dying from this. So it's not like we are, some people are saying we're back to normal. We're not back to normal. We're pretending we are, we are not. And hopefully by June we are, but like, this is a huge event that's going to be gathering. And so, you know, so to celebrate reuniting everything, it's like, it's a trade show. It's not,
right.
We're not sharing ice cream cake.
Well, this isn't even like a convention, like a MAGFest or a Portland where people get together and have fun together. This is, I mean, you do get some of that, but it's not its intended purpose.
No, it's not the intended purpose. It's to advertise new products coming out.
Right.
That's
exactly. Let's stop pretending that it's, you know, this feel good celebration of gaming.
And they invite like influencers out for some stuff. Maybe there's like the parties and shit that used to happen. You know, you get like the invites. All right, where's the Ubisoft parties? You get invited to that shit. They used to do that. I don't know if they probably don't spend that amount of money anymore, but that's what it used to be. It was the OG schmoozing people in person with drinks and, you know, things like that and free food. I don't think that happens anymore.
No.
So
not so much.
It is what it is. This CU podcast segment is brought to you by Into the AM. They have premium, high-quality apparel, including nice graphic tees, basic tees, hoodies, and even stuff like boxer briefs. You're wearing the stare down shirt, Ian. Look at that.
I sure am.
Nice anime looking thing.
I've also got the moon buggy shirt here.
And I'm wearing the high tide with the waves going on.
And that's a fancy one.
And then I also have the overseer in case you want to get abducted right there. You're outside there in your tent getting abducted. And then I have the lost signal tee, which is a CRT TV from the 80s. And they have a lot of nice 80s sort of style designs that are nice. So if you're into the retro sort of theme, you can check that out right there.
Yeah, these are super comfortable t-shirts, and there are different collections and themes, so there's something for everyone. They have space-themed shirts, animal themes, nature, you know, spookier, like skulls sort of themes, and like shirts that are good for festivals.
Yeah, and the shirts are very soft, they're pre-shrunk, they're tailored fit, and they use eco-friendly inks. And they're running a bundle deal right now for the graphic tees, which are 3 for $60, and they also have 3 basic tees for $50. So click the link in the description on YouTube, or if you're a podcast listener, use code CONTRI Contri, and you'll get 10% off these very comfortable shirts and gear. Go look good and feel good with Into the AM. All right, Ian.
Yes.
This was alerted on Twitter, this story, that a super NES dev kit was coming up for auction.
Yes. So, yeah, the announcement was, you know, that there was that dev kit coming out, and that led to links of a bunch of other video game related memorabilia and stuff being sold in LA. There was the Super NES dev kit. There's lots of Pong clones. There's Famicom systems. And, you know, that initially captured the public's attention because the Super NES dev kits, you don't see them very much. And also, I think it's because the starting bid for it is a fairly astronomical $20,000. And from what we've heard, it's not probably not worth $20,000.
It's hard to price out dev kits, but right. From my knowledge and historical thinking about it,
who is our man behind the scenes who told us that, like, without the software and stuff like
Kev
that?
Trist.
I know.
Kev Trist is not sure that this is that this is totally usable at this point in time. You need to use it on an old computer. You need the dev software to use this as well.
Right. So it's probably not built into this. I don't know.
But this was obviously, you know, given out to developers to make Super Nintendo games. It says Super NES Emulator SC. So in the past, you see these come up, I think, like Dreamcast ones, PlayStation ones. They would go for probably four figures, but lower four figures. They go for probably low thousands, something like that, just from my perspective.
Sure.
On these, because there's not a huge amount you can do with these. By and large, I think people would probably get some of them because there might be some maybe game builds on them to dump in the past, potentially.
I mean, other than that, it's just an interesting piece of history. Yeah. But it's a display piece. I think it's humorous that, to me, it looks like an Xbox Series X.
Yeah, it's a cube. It's like a giant. It's a tower. It's like a computer tower. So this is being auctioned off from Van Eaton Galleries, which is a weird auction house. They're in Southern California. They do like celebrity stuff. They do animation art on the website. Like, this is not something you would expect to see something like this come up. So why is this being auctioned, and you know what's going on here? Well, some people surmise, based upon the listing, this is the listing. This particular unit was used to create the audio for game franchises such as Earthworm Jim, Madden Football, Cool Spot, Jungle Book, Chuck Rock, and Jim Lee's Wildcats. So people surmised, wow, what is the audio have in common for those games?
That's Tommy Tallarico.
This is Tommy Tallarico's Super NES dev kit. It's his. He's the one auctioning it off here. And this was confirmed that he showed this exact unit in his My Retro Video Game Collection video from November of 2020, and it has the same exact markings. Not that there's a lot of these around to begin with, probably anyway, because they're supposed to go back to Nintendo, these dev kits, which is a whole different conversation. I'm not going to get into the legality of owning
someone. I don't give a shit about the legality. I mean, honestly, we don't like Tommy, but if someone else owned it, we'd think it was cool. So yeah. I don't really care.
No, we think it was cool.
It's fine.
Absolutely. But this is Tommy Tallarico's, the former CEO of Intellivision Entertainment, the current president still, and it has the same exact markings on it here. He's talking about it in his video here. It's his, and the fact that it's Southern California, but it's weird to go through something like Van Eaton Galleries, because I don't know if that's the audience for something like this. Like, the typical person that's going on to buy, some sort of art, fine art they have animation art. It seems like this is not in their wheelhouse for something like this. I'm looking at some of their auctions, Ian. They have stuff like, in the past, they have a Hanna-Barbera auction. They have a Mad Monster Party movie art show tribute. They have a Disneyland auction. They have a pet portrait day for the Beagle Freedom Project going back in time. That's from Disneyland, the Richard Kraft collection. They have all this Disney and like art stuff. They don't have video game stuff. So it's a weird venue to auction it off in general, because it has to get the same out to people. This isn't like people on eBay having safe searches and go, oh, dev kit, and it comes up, I'm emailed. This is something you'd have to be looking at this at this auction house, and this is not stuff they typically do here.
There's other stuff being auctioned off that people have surmised is...
Do you want to talk about the... We talked about the price a little bit, right? $20,000?
Oh, yeah, we did. We talked about that. It's insane. I was going to bring up
What's more insane is this, is that there's a 21% buyer's premium on top of all this stuff. 21%, which means that if you're going to go for this, you're looking at $24,000 on this, starting on it, which is nuts for that. And I'm not saying someone's not going to bid on this. I have no idea what the dev kit collecting community is. But that starting bid is going to throw off a lot of interest from the start. That's just my opinion.
Sure.
Versus starting at like $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 and seeing what happens. Sorry, what were you saying?
Nothing. I was just saying that in addition to that stuff, there was also, there's like, for instance, just speaking of pricing and the high prices, there's a collection of, not Odyssey, like 15 rare game consoles in one cassette. Basically, these are all Pong clones. Some of these are ones that I've never seen, but the starting price of $5,000 or $2,500 is pretty insane.
It's nuts. Okay.
Pong clones don't generally, and even the weird ones, at least in my time at Luna, and if something changed, someone can correct me, these don't go for anything.
They don't. They don't sell at conventions. I'm not saying they're not out there, because I used to compile some of these, and I still have a lot. I don't think in my days I've ever met someone that was like a huge Pong clone collector, that like, hey, I'm into buying all of these. They might exist. I just never met them. So with the buyer's premium, that would be, you're looking at, what, a Pat Math, you're looking at 20%, that's $3,000, starting $3,000 about. If you look up, what's the recognized, there's Super Pong on here. That's one of the more famous ones, because that's Atari, Super Pong console. What would that even go for? And these only have the boxes. Okay, they can't move at $50, the best offer for a Super Pong. That's a
there is a boxed color game. Was color game the Nintendo one? No, this is English. Never mind.
That's a generic one.
Okay, yeah.
Let's see. Pong color game. That's the box. What's the cassette? What was the cassette?
Not sure what the cassette is.
All right, so the color game, someone's trying to get 175, trying to get 175. I can't find any completed auctions for that color game. So here's the point. If I had to ballpark this, Ian, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. There's about 15 consoles here, including the Bentley CompuVision. This would have to be, you have to justify $200 each to get the 3,000 starting bid on that. I don't see that as a thing.
No.
I'd say $100 each is even an exorbitant price for something like that. A Bentley CompuVision. They just have cute little boxes. $35 in the box. Okay, I thought that was going to hit 100. Those are worthless. Those are worthless. So I think the average price of all this stuff would be $50 each. I think the average, this is like $600 worth of stuff, in my opinion. So that begs the question, why is the starting price so high? Why is the starting bid so high? And who sets it? Did Van Eaton Galleries, who deals in fine art and animation, set it? Or did Tommy Tallarico set the prices of these auctions to these insane amounts? I will be shocked if this gets a bid on it. I'll be shocked.
Sure.
Absolutely shocked. Because just looking at a couple of these, I think I own that TV game. I own that Telesports game one in the box, for example. Telesports, Pong, in the box. I'll be shocked if it's $50. Can't find one for sale. I'm sorry, Ian. $24 the best offer in the box.
Yeah, I was looking up a Soundic one. Yeah, I am not finding anything that goes higher than... Because I always think there's got to be one Pong console out there that's worth something. But
why would it be, though? Because there's 1,000 of them. That's the thing. Like, why would they be? That's the argument. How about the Granada one? Granada Pong, I can't find it. I cannot find one there. I found a Granada Williams pinball kit from 72. So that's an insane amount. So I guess, Tommy needs cash, and that's why this stuff's coming up. For sale. I don't think this is going to be bid on. Neither will the Nintendo. There's a Game & Watch Super Mario Brothers VGA 95 mint uncirculated for $200. I mean, those don't go for $200, and it just has grading on it. That's just a weird thing. I'm going to guess that's Tommy's as well, because the rest are here. Then there's the Famicom console accessories and game collection lot 480. With a minimum bid of $5,000.
You would know more about this than I would.
Which would be, pat math, 20%, $6,000. Excuse me, 21%. They had to put an extra 1% on, which bothers me. Because I think 20%.
That is really...
Really annoying.
That is really chapping your ass.
Because in theory, I think 20% is way too high for auction houses to take. I think that's unreasonable in a lot of these cases. I think there should be a cap on some of these. Or at least a minimum, and then it caps. But that's nuts. So for $6,000, Ian... You get the following. You get two twin Famicoms, which are the dual. There was the ones that came out after both are out. It's like the Turbo Duo.
They're so cool looking. I love them.
You get the cartridges and you get the Famicom disc as well. Two of those. You get a boxed Family Basic keyboard. You get a boxed data recorder. You get a boxed Famicom. You get a boxed disc system. You get the boxed ROB, which comes with the jar of my stuff, and you get the box stack-up thing. I looked up some of these. I'll look up a couple more here. Something like the keyboard goes for... You can get the keyboard for under $150 with the box. Oh, fuck it. I'm gonna freaking list these. I'm going to do it on my phone. If you want to price out some of these and help me, maybe that's the way to go on this. We're going to price them out. I'll put $150 for the keyboard there. I priced out the Famicom robot shit was about 100. We'll put 120 about. The stack up thing, I believe, was about 100. I'll be generous on some of these. Do you want to look up the data recorder for me?
The Famicom data recorder?
Yeah, because that one I don't know off the top of my head. And I'll look up the Famicom console. It would probably be 150 for the Famicom. Oh, no, it's nothing. It's about, I'll be generous on that. I'll put 200 for both of them combined for the console and for the disc.
Box complete. Someone's asking for 310 on the data recorder. There's a loose one. People are asking 174. Another one for 206.
In the box, 200?
No, that's loose.
I'll put 300. I'll be generous. So we're up to 920. And what's left? I did both the disk system and the regular one. What do we got left there, Ian? What do we got left that I haven't accounted for?
No, I think that's it.
That's about it. And then the games F1 race, Tsubasa, and baseball. I'll guess those are $50 total. Unless you look up,
I'll look up the Tecmo soccer game, Arabic version.
I'm struggling to get to $1,000 is my point.
Sure.
I am struggling, and I was generous on a couple of these. If you want to say I'm crazy, Pat, the data recorder, I'll put it on another $200. I'll say this is $1,200 worth of stuff. I'll say it's $1,200 worth of stuff. Because the Twin Famicoms, yeah, I forgot the Twin Famicoms. The Twin Famicoms, no, I did put those. The Twin Famicoms are about $120 each. This is like, I'll say $1,300 worth of stuff. And they're, and either the auction house or Tommy recommended, they ask $5,000 for this stuff. That is nuts. That's nuts. This is, I'm not trying to make a big deal of this, but this is someone that has no awareness of the value of the stuff, or really is hoping that some moron that is into fine art sees this auction and is like, well, this must be worth at least $5,000 because it's listed. I'm going to hit the bid on it. Like, it makes no sense for this stuff to be priced out like four times what it's actually is worth as a starting bid. It makes no sense.
What's that? So that Arabic version Tsubasa, I think that's a bootleg. I think that's a ROM patch. Yeah, that's a ROM patch cart being sold physically.
Oh, you're right. Look at the cheap yellow.
It doesn't look anything.
That's
like
a bootleg.
A real, yeah, it's a bootleg.
There's a bootleg here, Tommy.
It's a translated bootleg.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, because there's no information or anything on it. That's clearly a bootleg.
It's the cheap yellow ones you see for sale sometimes, and then F1 race that. That's actually kind of an interesting one to look at. F1 race Famicom disc. I'm at $1,300. I'm at $1,300 on this stuff. The F1 race is $20, $30 maybe. No, $12. It's cheap. This is 12. So, Ian, do you have any thoughts about why it'll be so wildly overpriced to start? Like, I just don't understand it.
Well, I think there is possible. It's possible that there is something with the auction house. I think people tend to look at sets of video games and the people who this might be sold to, because this is not a website that is known for video game auctions. I think they might get people that look at a nice boxed collection of something and just assume that it's worth the asking price. You can get away with a lot of that.
There's a couple more here. There's a couple more. There's an Atari lot, Ian. Lot 479 mm-hmm. is on there. And there's also an Odyssey set. The Odyssey set I'll talk about is interesting. This one, I don't need to go on eBay to price this one, Ian. I don't know if you see it. $479 if you want to search for Atari and it'll come up. This is an Atari 7800 in the box. An Atari 2600 for Switch. An Atari 2600 Junior, the silver small one. An Atari XE, four Atari computer games, an Atari 7800 loose, excuse me, three Atari 7800 games, and then you have, it looks like, is that a 5200 there? So, yes. Ian.
No.
So, what do you think that should be worth? What do you think that would be worth? If you were at Luna selling an Atari XE, an Atari 2600, seven Atari games, and an Atari 2600 Junior, like, what would that go for?
I mean, I would tell them that, honestly, they would probably be better off putting it on eBay or Craigslist without the ability to really accurately test all of these systems. I wouldn't be willing to pay a whole lot of money for them to begin with. Plus, it would take forever for them to sell. I would probably, and if they, like, forced me to offer them some money, I mean...
You'd offer them, like, $250 and sell it for $500, maybe?
I'm just being honest. I probably wouldn't want it bad enough to offer more than one.
What would you retail?
I wouldn't want it, and I would retail it for probably 60 each on the Atari, the 2600, and the juniors would probably be close to 100. The 7800 would probably be 50 to 60, and the
box? Okay.
The Atari, is that an XE?
Yeah, on the right.
With the gun and everything.
Like 150 maybe?
Maybe 150.
So this is $500 worth of stuff.
Sure, yeah.
The starting base, $2,500 on this stuff. $2,500. There's nothing special about it. Oh, there's a Jax Pacific 2002 plug and play on top. Besides the 7,800 in the box, which, I mean, that's interesting in the box.
I guess. I mean, yeah, in the box, it would be more than 50, but a 7,800 is not worth much.
No, yeah. No. That's nuts. The only interesting one to me is the Odyssey one, 478, because I think there's something signed by Ralph Baer on here. You have an original Mandelbox Odyssey in the box. You have the Odyssey Pong clones. They came out before the Pong, but you have the 200 in the box, the 2000. I think I own both of those. You have the 500. You have an Odyssey 2 loose. You have the shooting gallery in the box, and you have that Red Odyssey clone, or Red Odyssey unit, what has the three on each side. You ever see this one? You've seen this one before, right?
Yeah.
I might own it. So this one is interesting because it's all earlier-ish, like early to mid-70s Odyssey stuff. Besides, Odyssey 2 was 80, or is it 79, 80? Is there anything signed here by Ralph Baer? The Odyssey 2 is signed by Ralph Baer. Okay. Even though I don't know why he would sign the Odyssey 2 when he wasn't working on it. I don't think he worked on that one that much.
I have no idea.
But anyway, so this is interesting stuff just because a boxed Odyssey is not something you see every day, but this stuff still can be found. Odyssey 1972 box. I'm actually interested to know what these actually go for because I've been so out of it. Okay, they are 600 or best offer on those, so we'll just say that's worth $500, and the shooting gallery probably goes for $200, but I'm not positive. Okay, someone's trying to get $1,400 for a shooting gallery. That's not happening. No one cares. Oh, that includes a box one. I'll say the shooting gallery is worth $250, and then the Odyssey 2 is worth with Ralph Baer's signature. I don't know. That's what up to you. I'll say $300-$400, and then the clones are worth garbage. This, Ian, is a maybe I would say $1,000 worth of stuff, but the starting bid is $2,500 on it. But this is the only one that's interesting because it has a Ralph Baer signature. That's the only thing interesting, but it's not on the original Odyssey, which is weird. That's the only thing. So maybe Tommy ran into Ralph at a convention or met him once, said, hey, I have an Odyssey 2 for you to sign and do that. You'd want him to sign the original Odyssey. That's what I want him to sign. So that's in poor but displayable condition, the signed Odyssey, according to this. So you have about five auctions with pie-in-the-sky unrealistic prices on these. I mean, I'm flabbergasted. I thought that one of these would come at least to 50% of the value underneath and be like, okay, but not like 20% of the values on some of these. And then also, it was kind of shocking to see for sale, since Tommy is a huge Spider-Man fan, two things in particular. You have the Spider-Man comic book collection. He used to brag it was the biggest Spider-Man collection, I think, because it was like multiple thousands of comics. So you have the run of Spider-Man 1 to 125 on here. You have the Web of Spider-Man run. You have other stuff on here. The starting bid is $200,000 on that. What's interesting to me to see something like that is that you would get a bidder on that if you had a very detailed list of all these comics and what the conditions were. That's the only way you can get any close to approximation of value on a comic set like this. So like the Amazing Fantasy 15, the first Spider-Man appearance, is a 7.0, which is a great grade, but it's a restored grade. And the same for the first Spider-Man one. But if someone was going to buy these, they'd have to know, are these graded? Which ones are graded and what's the grades? And looking at the lot, it doesn't look like most of them are graded. So to me, that could be pie in the sky as well. I mean, I'm going to look up Amazing Fantasy 7.0 just to see what it goes for, but what it goes for restored, because restored are never close to the amount of a non-restored comic. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. Yeah, so a 7.0 unrestored universal grade, someone's trying to get $175,000 for it. I have no idea what a restored would go for, like an open auction. So
less.
A lot less. I don't know if it's 50% less, 25% less.
I don't know.
No idea. And then finally, we have the Spider-Man life-size statue that was in Tommy's Spider-Man cave for sale there. So you have that there, too. So,
all right. Well, that's a lot of auctions. A lot of stuff.
I hope Tommy makes some money. He's obviously in need, it looks like, if all this stuff from his collection is going. I guess we'll check back in 10 days to see what these end at. And do you think, honestly, gun to your head, any of these video game auctions will be bid on and won by an actual person?
I can't say anything really necessarily about the Super Nintendo dev kit. I don't think so, and I definitely don't think so for the rest of it.
I would say the dev kit, if there's a Nintendo collector who's been looking for one of these for 10 years and can't find one, and say, fuck it, I want to pay $20,000 for just a piece that'll just sit there. You really can't do much with it. Not for these other auctions for the Famicom stuff or the Odyssey or the Pong clothes. It's mostly, or the Atari stuff. It's not worth it. It's ridiculous. Ian, we have a Patreon, don't we?
We have a Patreon. You go to patreon.com/CU podcast and, you know, you take a look at what we offer. And if you enjoy what we offer, if you think you'd like to support us or perhaps get some extra stuff, part with some money. You get the full video podcast. Mm-hmm. You get bonus bits, bonus extra podcast content, usually in the range of about 15 to 20 minutes, where we discuss a wide variety of topics. This morning we talked about astronaut ice cream, space, all sorts of things.
We talked about astronaut ice cream, space?
Astronaut ice cream, comma,
and space. Oh, comma, space. Okay. Yeah.
And then you get to vote in these poll topics. You get a hangout once a month. You can. There's a pin club, and I do writing about once a week.
Yeah, you've been talking about your Buffalo Bills experience a bit so far the past few weeks. In second place is grading or reselling worse for game collecting, 24%. And in a blowout here, Pat and Ian respond to the Carl and Mad Dog collection. A video where I am brought up. Ian will lead off.
Yeah, so basically there was after we recorded last week, there was a mediated discussion between Carl Jobst and Mad Dog, mediated by, what was his name?
D-Rob.
It's D-Rob. And, you know, basically to kind of try to come to an agreement and talk out the drama and the situation.
Because Carl did a video Carl did a video going back, talking about the collusion and then the Heritage Auctions buffoonery between them and WADA. And then Mad Dog put a video earlier this year attacking Carl and attacking me, which we discussed last week. And this was a follow-up to the Carl video then going back after Mad.
Correct. So on your way.
Oh, that's all I got to say. So it's interesting that this conversation happened, I think, just because Carl gives, I think, this individual way too much credit for being someone that's going to come to the table with an honest discourse and for someone that's going to be, quote unquote, I guess, arguing or discussing in good faith. And I had a conversation with Carl about most of the points I'm going to bring up with him, about him and the conversation discourse. But the first thing I said to Carl is that you basically, you're lowering yourself talking to someone like this to begin with, because they are not going to be discussing anything in good faith.
No, the video was not in good faith. I would not trust them to say anything in good faith. One thing that I will point out, and you're going to like start playing it, but the one, before I forget it, the one thing that really stuck out to me was when they asked Mad Dog about the editing of the line.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I have a lot to say. So, D-Rob or Dave is the individual we've discussed. Like I said, super nice guy whenever I talk to him. He sold next to us at Long Island 3 years ago. He also appeared on Pawn Stars with the Sealed Atari games a year and a half ago,
whenever that was.
Mm-hmm. Same person. So we're going to go through this, and I have some thoughts, and Ian does. It's about 8 minutes of this. All right, here we go.
There's a problem. Okay, I was saying to this to Dave earlier. it's totally fine if you want to talk about how valuable games are, and it's great that games are becoming so valuable and stuff like that. Totally your choice. But the public reaction to that is going to be negative. Like, almost always, in my opinion.
I'm not sure I agree with Carl about there's a negative reaction on surface to people talking about expensive games. I think there has to be a context to it. Because we've talked about sales of games going back on the podcast years and years. And I don't think people ever came after the fact that, you know, an NWC cart was going for a lot of money, or Steam events. You always get people saying these games shouldn't be that expensive. But it wasn't the same vitriolic reaction, by and large, that you've gotten with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think part of it is, you know, with early game collecting and things being expensive, it was pretty easy to see the reasoning why the stuff was expensive. It was just based purely on rarity. We weren't talking grades, seals. We weren't, talking, necessarily a lot of variants. It was, this game is expensive because this game is hard to find. End of story. People understood that. That was it.
Or some historical basis tagged onto it.
Sure.
For like, NWC carts.
Sure. Well, that also, rarity though, too. There.
Sure.
And I think it depends what your audience you want to appeal to, I guess. So I think it's something to think about. For me, I think, and the whole idea of trying to distinguish between steeled collectors and not steeled collectors, I don't think that's going to be work out positively, because I think it's creating more division.
So this comment, I think, goes back to when I first heard this. I wasn't sure if he was referring to the collective community creating a division, or just focusing the fact that it's always existed. The fact that sealed game collector was always a niche of a niche to begin with. Going back to my experience on Atari Age in the late 2000s, early 2010s.
Atari Age or Nintendo
Age? Excuse me, Nintendo Age. My favorite website. Going back to Nintendo Age, where I'd have arguments and discussions with people that were pushing for graded sealed game stuff way back then. They were pushing for it,
sure,
and trying to pump it up. But it was such a small portion of even people on Nintendo Age. We're talking, I'd be shocked if you told me it was 30 individuals.
Who were into the sealed?
Yes. Yeah. Like, we're talking small, small amounts of people that were back then. So I will say this, it's a division because it's an entirely different mindset about collecting them. And that's what I'll get into more, is that the people that are into exclusively sealed games, and I'll go back to exclusive, people are into exclusively sealed games.
I think that's a pretty, that's something you need to make sure you're saying, though, is exclusively into sealed games.
Yes.
You own sealed stuff. You know, it's not a crazy thing to own sealed stuff.
No.
It's the exclusivity of
it's
the exclusive. Collecting.
It's a percentage. We'll just say anyone that owns, like, I don't know, more than 50%.
Okay. You know? Let's not get into percentages.
Because if you say I own sealed games, yeah, I own like 50 games out of thousands.
Yes.
You know, it's like, it's a happenstance versus
it
objective.
It wasn't an insult.
No, I'm not thinking
that's
insult.
Why you have to differentiate.
Sure.
Where I think the message would be better, be like, no, we are collectors too, and this is why. If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. I guess the sealed community of people that first of all have the money to buy sealed games, and then second of all, that are actually in the market to buy them.
It's so small.
Such a niche market that, I personally, for my YouTube channel, it was only for the Instagram community of video game, collectors. It was not meant for you have 700,000 followers.
Mad Dog, which I believe his real name is Garth. I like to call him by his real name to have some level of decorum here. His argument was that when he made the video, that was just obviously deceitful, obviously misrepresenting, obviously lying, was that it was not for the consumption of the public outside of his baked in audience, where he probably, shows off his sealed game collection. That's what he's saying right now. Okay.
Not even 1% of that is going to be collecting games. Right. So, that's why I set my account to private. Like, I have no interest in those, in people that anyways, That's all good.
No, I understand that. I would probably do the same thing.
Yeah.
I totally understand that. But what's your thoughts though on what I said about
with the
trying to create this distinction between sealed collectors and not?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's necessarily a good strategy.
My whole point with Pat Contry, where you basically rolled it back one sentence and it was like, holy crap, this guy is misleading, blah, blah, blah. Well, I didn't even know about that sentence until you pointed it out.
Okay, so. Pause. So that's the one thing in here that I actually have a big comment on is you just admitted to not doing any sort of due diligence in your video. You grabbed a quote. Did not bother to look into it, slapped it on there and represented it as such. You can't explain that away. I mean, that's not an explanation. That's laziness.
It's either willful ignorance.
It's willful ignorance.
Or you're lying and right. You knew what you were doing.
Sure.
I would argue he doesn't have, he hasn't built up the cachet to in my eyes, to say this was an innocent mistake versus no, I willfully misrepresented what Pat said by cutting up the clips the way I did. When you're editing, Ian, you have to look at the entire sentence structure take the cuts.
One, I agree with you, but two, what he's saying is the clip existed. He saw the clip someplace else. Someone else must have used it, so he used the clip.
Oh, no, he had to have downloaded that video.
But yes.
He downloaded my video.
I agree. I'm just saying what he's saying and what you're saying.
And I'm saying what he's saying isn't true.
Why did you pull that clip from somewhere else or what?
So I was really more into the editing of this video in a humorous way than.
There he admits it.
Time watching Pat's videos. So for me, I spent more time photoshopping Michael Jordan's jersey on that guy at the barbecue than I did. Video. So to be frank, when you rolled that, you know, yeah, it makes it look like I'm misleading, but
because you are.
What was
the sense? You didn't expect it to get the views that it did. I guess.
Who cares?
What? Hey, what does D-Rob, that have to do with
what
anything?
What does it matter how many people watch it? Are you lying and misrepresenting or not?
Right.
What does it matter if two people saw it or 2,000 or 20,000? Are you being deceitful or not? That's ridiculous.
Yes.
You're twisting my words and having me say things I never said and cutting up things. That it doesn't matter how many fucking people saw it.
Right.
And this is where I start to get annoyed.
Yeah.
It had 2,000 views. I didn't think it'd be putting.
That's a lot, though. I mean, it's more than my videos get. So.
But, you know, I still believe.
Oh, so, only 2,000 people, so I can lie about someone else. That's fine.
That's
disgusting. And Carl, I wish called him out on that and said, like, what does it matter?
Yeah.
What does it fucking matter?
I only lied to a small amount of people.
I still stand by my point that, you know, you referenced Pat as your expert in that video for sealed video games. And just my whole point behind that is
he didn't reference me as an expert when it came to sealed video games. He referenced me as an expert in terms of the collecting as a whole. I never said I was an expert on sealed game collecting. That was never stated anywhere that I was. But in terms of collecting as a whole, I am probably regarded as such as someone who's been in it for 25 years. And that's why, you know, he reached out to me originally to ask what was up, you know, with some of these insane game prices. And it was just common sense. He could have asked anyone else about it.
You know, at one point, let's say in the 1960s, there were guys that owned an Action Comics 1, and they were upset when it, you know, hit $100. I'm saying to interview that person when a $3.5 million sale happens, to interview the guy that was upset when they were worth $100.
This is a lie. This is a misrepresentation and a fucking lie. He's trying to make the argument, and I wish there was pushback, that I'm a person that ever got pissed off that retro games went up in value. That's what he's saying. He's saying that I'm a guy that always said or said that, oh, this game should always have been only $50. And that's never been my stance.
That's usually the straw man argument people have been used.
I've always used. I've never said anything negative about game prices going up if I thought it was a naturally organic occurring thing and if it was not being market manipulated.
always. That's such a blatant lie. Had I known this conversation was going to go this way, I would have wished I was asked to be on it. Would you have wanted to be on it if you were being represented like this?
Well, sure.
I'm a guy that wishes a $100 comic from the 60s never went up in value just because I'm a lunatic. Like, what the fuck?
Yes, he's a collector just the same, but he's the wrong guy to get advice on a $3.5 million market.
Why would I be? Like, why would I be? I can comment on something, a $50,000 game, but not a $1 million game. It's the same games that have existed. Oh, my God.
My point, you know? And
well, so, I agree with that.
Guys in the room, stop fighting, please.
If you actually bring forward the points like that, in that kind of way,
mm-hmm.
we'll probably agree.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the when I start fighting back is just even just doing it in a way that's kind of either not, it's just bad faith kind of arguments.
Okay.
For example, like,
thanks, Carl.
Pat is very anti-Seal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he's way more anti-Seal. Well, I'm not anti-Seal at all.
Which is weird, but let's touch on.
Well, they're saying I'm anti-Seal, Ian. I think what Carl is saying is that I'm against the existence of people collecting sealed games. And I've never said you cannot buy or own a sealed game before. And I think this is where it gets to be dicey. And this is what I talked to Carl about, is I think he misrepresented my actual stance versus what he thought I meant on certain things. I think what they're about to get into is to say that I have some weird vendetta against anyone owning a sealed game, when obviously that would be a just insane stance to take, because obviously sealed games exist. They're bought and sold. And I've bought sealed games before. I bought, a Top Secret episode. I this is one of my favorite NES games. This is a sealed version. And I bought this because I love Top Secret Episode. So this would disprove that point on its surface. And yes, I own the cart version because I like to play little Google 13 here. Okay, what's...
Real quick, though, isn't it weird that he's anti-seal? Like, why can't he just leave it alone? Why does he have to be against it?
I've left alone people buying and selling graded games forever. How many times did we used to bring up before the WADA stuff, Ian, and the collusion weird stuff? How many segments did we used to talk about sealed games on the podcast?
None.
You want to be generous and say we talked about it maybe 3 or 4 times in like 8 years?
Sure, it wasn't a topic of conversation.
When did we get annoyed by it?
I mean, grading and collect. Grading was when we got annoyed by it.
And more annoyed when we started to see the weird stuff like the Pawn Stars appearance.
Sure.
That's when we got annoyed. We started to get annoyed when we saw games that were counterfeit or repro games being graded. We started to get annoyed when we saw fake prototypes being authenticated as real. We started to get annoyed when we saw all these connections coming together. The same ones that other people like Carl saw and did his video about. This is another straw man. This is not true. This is not true at all.
I don't know, but I've tried to say to him, can collect sealed games and just because you think sealed games are cool. And why I like sealed games, I just think sealed games are cool. And he was insinuating that, no, it's more to do with money and stuff like that, which
Okay. So this was a Discord conversation, and I have the screenshots. I'm not going to go into them. But my stance was on this was that when you have someone that's a quote-unquote exclusive, we want to call them sealed game collector or speculator, is that it's not coming from the place of a regular collector does when they buy in the games.
Sure.
and love them because they grew up with them, they want to play them again. People that come into a video game store, that's an entirely different customer than someone that goes and just goes on eBay or tries to do deals with individuals to get sealed games to grade them. That's an entirely different type of collector. And I don't think I'm insane for saying that. I don't. Because this is the conversations I used to have on Nintendo Age back. I used to have conversations with Bronte. Bronte was one of the guys that he almost got a sealed NES set or did. And he's the guy that ended up selling the $100,000 Super Mario Brothers to Jim Halpern and Rich Lecce and the other partner that ended up on Pawn Stars. I used to get in the conversations with Bronte way back. If this archive, you can find them. Discussing how the differences between someone who collects video games
the quote unquote traditional collector versus the sealed collector, because the intent basically changes what it is at some point. And Bronte, actually, to his credit, agreed with me on some of the points we'd have going back and forth on these fucking forum conversations about that. Yes, Pat, he was like, Pat, you're probably right in some respects that this is not the same thing as a traditional game collector. Moving on.
I mean, so
He's got high-end items. He told me he's got like a sealed Gyromite somewhere. Like, I talked to the guy. He's got sealed stuff. But why does he have to be against it, you know?
Ian, did I ever come to you in shame and say, like, oh, I have a sealed game, I shouldn't own it? Did I ever say that to you ever?
No.
Or it's just, oh, it's sealed, I happen to have it.
Yeah.
Dave here is referring to the fact I had a conversation with him probably at Long Island, and I'm kind of annoyed that he's trying to use a private conversation against me like this, but that's another conversation, is that I have that exclusive NES test market set up there that I got in Jersey. And inside of it, it had everything in it but the NES console. It had the ROB, it had all the pieces,
right,
and it had the Gyromite and Duck Hunt. And the Gyromite has the sticker seal on it, but it's closed. And it's in mint condition, and it's hard to tell if it was somehow opened and then resealed, because the sticker is 100% intact. So I brought the conversation that someone said that combined with my Duck Hunt game, which is pristine, it's been opened, could be worth $40,000. And I relayed that to him. And now he's trying to use that point against me by the fact that I own them, that I shouldn't be owning them, or that my mind is so fucked up that I don't think I should own them. I don't know what he's trying to say, but I'm annoyed that he's used a private conversation I had in good faith now against me years later. Next.
And he wasn't, he's obviously forward enough that he hasn't sold that stuff. So I'm like, you know, is this more for your show? And if it is, that's fine too. Why is he against it?
I'm not against people owning sealed games. I've never said you should not own a sealed game. Find me the quote where Ian says or I say that you should not own sealed games. Find me that quote. Or maybe Garth can cut up some lines of different footage from me to make it say that I said that.
No, he on his podcast or whatever, he portrays himself accurately.
Yeah.
Because I've spoken to him privately, and I know how he feels privately. Yeah, if he was like just putting on an act in his show, then he would tell me, you know, I'm not really against sealed. Because I wanted him to come on to, I wanted to settle this, you know, and I said to him, hey, I'll put you in my new video, and I'm like, just say that you don't have a problem with sealed games.
Right.
That's like a reasonable stance, right? To be right. Like, I don't, yeah. I think speculation's bad, but I just, in principle, I don't have a problem. But even that seemed to be an issue.
Okay. So I think Carl jumped to a conclusion. We had a conversation on Discord where he asked me to give my comments about it. And I didn't say yes, I was going to be in it, and I didn't say no. What I was basically trying to say was, at the time, was that, well, first of all, I didn't know where he was going to go with the video, what he was going to do. I also didn't know who else was going to appear in the video. So I didn't want to agree to be in a video if I didn't know who else was appearing,
sure,
what their motivations were. And I should have actually said that. I should have said, who else is appearing in this video and what the hell is going on before you want my comment on it? Like, because I knew last year that he sent me the script before it came out last year, I believe, of the September video where me and Sean appeared in it. So I knew exactly what was going to be in it. So I felt uncomfortable with that. I just didn't want it. I didn't want me to come off as weird, like where it's like, oh, I got all these sealed games. Oh, everything's cool in the scene. I didn't know what was happening with that. But I think what's happening here is they're trying to conflate me or you and you, because your points are probably the same as mine when it comes to this. They're trying to conflate the motivation behind the people that are basically in the scene and pushing this stuff versus the existence of sealed games and people wanting to own them. And they're conflating both to be the same thing. They're trying to say that Pat's against sealed games, when it should be Pat is against people that are speculating on sealed games that are manipulating the market.
Sure. That makes sense.
And they're conflating the both together.
Yeah.
And that's what's annoying. And that's what no one is trying to separate out.
So yeah, I'm putting on an act. I think that's what he really believes, you know. we're gonna
buy, I'm not whatever. Saying he doesn't believe it on some level. I just, but he's on the same, he does believe it. I've heard it, you know, I've talked to him directly, but on the same token, he's got high end valuables that, like, people, he said he, at one point, this was back in like 2020, I think he told me he got offered $40,000+ for one of his games and he wouldn't sell it. And that,
okay, that he's referring to the conversation about the Gyromite and the Duck Hunt, where someone, it wasn't a firm offer, and I'm not sure why he's bringing it up, but someone valued the Gyromite and Duck Hunt at like $40,000 for both. That was happening. That's what I told him. This was a polite, kind conversation. He was next to me at Long Island all weekend.
It's, if he doesn't like high end stuff, then he likes everything open, then open it. And yeah, I don't know. It's just, it seems to be contradiction to me.
Well, why would that be contradictory that I can own stuff worth money?
Well, again, it's just that, well, I think it's conflating the two mindsets.
Okay. The next quote here is an unfortunate one, but I have to really zone in on this here, because this is the one where it was out of bounds.
At one point, this was back in like 2020, I think he told me he got offered $40,000+ for one of his games and he wouldn't sell it. And it's, if he doesn't like high end stuff, then he likes everything open, then open it. And yeah, I don't know. It's just, it seems to be contradiction to me.
I think he's just not as rich.
Okay. I had this conversation with Carl on Discord. I'm going to be polite about this, and I was polite. First of all, the amount of money I own or do not own is not relevant at all to any conversation when it comes to this. My stance on sealed game collecting, or people colluding, people being cahoots, people trying to push what I think is a speculative bubble, has absolutely zero to do with how much money I have on my persons or in my bank account. And my views on this, Ian, have not changed in a dozen years on what I think about this stuff.
Sure. Yeah, they haven't.
So that is out of bounds. That's out of bounds to bring up what money I have in my pocket at all or do not have.
Maybe. I don't know. It just seems like a contradiction. In any event, I don't see why he's got to be against sealed games. Like, you can do your CIB stuff. You can do card only. You can do the entire NES library. But like, why do you have to be against somebody else doing something different?
Well, again, it's conflating people owning something versus how they are manipulating a market or using a market to their monetary advantage. There's only a couple little more on here.
Yeah, I don't know.
So,
and trust me, I wanted to get that out of him, but I couldn't. So
no, yeah. It was clear. It was pretty clear.
No, it's not going to happen.
But yeah, like Pat and I disagree on certain things. But I agree that he's not an ex. Like he's not. Like in hindsight, it's kind of it muddies the water a little bit. Like I agree with what you're saying about Pat not being the right person to speak for sealed collecting and stuff like that. Totally understand that. Right. And I wasn't privy to that when I made the video, okay?
But that's not why Carl got in touch with me. He didn't get in touch with me because whether or not I was a sealed game expert. That was not what the video was about. But he got in touch with me because Ian and I were discussing this stuff for over a year before he did his video. For like a year and a half, we were talking about the connections between Jim Halperin and Dennis Kahn. And Jim Halperin being one of the three people that bought the Super Mario Brothers, and then that cart then appears on Pawn Stars. That's why he got in touch with me. So I'm not saying there's anything weird going on in this conversation, but I don't think it tells the entire story. And so this is where I'm going to end at. I don't know why the fuck I was brought up at all at the beginning of this conversation, but I know why. But if they were being honest, they would ask themselves, why am I being brought up? Like why am I being brought up? Why is the focus on me? And the focus is on me is because even if Ian and I, when we speak about this stuff, if we give a cautionary angle to talking about this stuff, we might prevent someone from jumping into this market.
Yeah.
Even if it's five people.
And the market doesn't stay alive without fresh additions.
They lose money. Talking about Garth and Dave, they lose money unless more people jump into this pool of collectors. They lose money. They know that, and we know that. So when we say this stuff and give sort of a – or Sean from Reserve Investments, we give a cautionary tale about be careful this stuff, there's some weird stuff going on here. There's more of these sealed games than you may know, and there's still more to come out. They don't like that. If they truly were, quote, collectors, and they didn't care about the monetary value and really were in this for the love of it, they would love what Ian and I would say, because that means if less people jump in to buy it, wow, the prices of everything available comes down. They can buy more of it. They can then have more for their collection at a much cheaper entry level. But that's not what's going on here. And that's where I'm going to get back to, and I'll end this up before we go over time, is that the reason why there's a division between traditional video game collectors and the speculative folks into the seal stuff is because the primary focus and reason they get into it. And I'm not going to say 100%. I'll say 96% get into it is because they want a return on their investment. Sure. It may not be next week. It may not be next year. It could be 5 years from now or 10 years now. They want the equity of what they put their money in to go up. That's the main difference. And that's why I'm brought up in conversation when I should not be. That's why I'm attacked, because I keep recycling the same points to drill it, to drill the truth into people's heads about that. Any last thoughts? That's it.
No, that's pretty much it.
I'm annoyed that I was brought up. You should not, if I'm a crazy person and Anita is a crazy person when it comes to this, you should not care what we have to say about it. If we're fucking lunatics when it comes to this, you should not care what we have to say, especially since you can buy more stuff for your collection at a cheaper price because there's less people buying it. Wouldn't you want to win? But no, that's not what you want. That's not what you want. I would have loved for less people to have bought NES games, Ian. It would have cost me a hell of a lot less for me to buy my fucking Bubble Bath Babes and my Hot Slots carts and my Myriad 6-in-1 and the NWC cart. I would have loved for them to be $100 games or $50 games, because that wasn't a primary reason why I bought them. I didn't buy the NWC cart thinking, oh, next week it's going to be worth 10 times the amount. I didn't think about that. I bought it because it was a historical piece and it was important. That's why I got it. All right, is that it?
That's it.
This portion of the CU podcast is brought to you by Gel Blaster Surge. Get ready to change the way you play. This revolutionary toy blasts water-based gelets that are natural and non-toxic. No stains, no residue, no mess. This is for real, Ian. We tested this with our safety goggles that comes with the Gel Blaster Surge. Safety first. This is great, great fun right here.
Remember those like water battles we all had as kids?
Yes.
We'd walk around with water balloons and stuff like that. Well, we didn't have the Gel Blaster.
The Gel Blaster Surge can fire the gelets 100 plus feet.
If you're interested in the Gel Blaster Surge, it's got a lot of great features. It's rechargeable with a USB-C cord. It comes with 10,000 gelets, and it holds 800 in the hopper, so you can play for a long time in between refills and recharges.
10,000 gelets it comes with, and it blasts in single fire or fully automatic mode.
It's really, really fast. The pellets are non-toxic for your kids or pets, so there's no danger there, and it's relatively painless.
Grab a bunch of these, go out to the field, have a blast. Get it? Have a blast?
I do get it. That's good.
We did mention that comes with the safety goggles. Always, always fashionable. You want to have fun out there? Get outside, get moving with the Gel Blaster Surge. You can click the link in our description or go to gelblaster.com and use our code GBCUPodcast to get 15% off your Gel Blaster order. That's gelblaster.com and use our code GBCUPodcast. Get yourself a Gel Blaster and get blasting. Ian, we got voicemails.
Oh, we do. How do you get those? How do you access those? How do you leave one?
You go to anchor.fm/CU podcast, and I think you do it via web or your smartphone. Keep them short and sweet. 20 seconds, I love you. 20 seconds is that sweet spot. Hey, I'm from here. Here's my question or whatever. And you're off and running. And here is the first one.
Pat and Ian, this is your Prunedale friend, Chris. Upstate friend, I just wanted to ask, because I'm watching your video of crash of sealed video game prices, it just occurred to me that, don't you think that the seals themselves can be faked? The plastic sealing, the boxes, especially with N64 games where the boxes are cheap as heck, Don't you think those seals and boxes can be faked too?
The seals, you need a really expensive machine to do the seals.
Yeah, I mean, the type of sealing that is done on them is, like, you would have to do a big run at a professional factory to get anything close to that.
You could if you had one of those professional factories, though. You probably could pull it off. Absolutely.
So this is Casey from Oregon, I have a question just for Pat, because I know Ian does not like to drive, which, Ian, I don't blame you. But Pat, what cars have you all owned throughout your life, and which one was your favorite?
I only have owned two, so I don't have either as a favorite. But the first one I owned was a Geo Prism, which got like 44 probably highway miles per gallon because it was so small.
Yeah.
And the turn radius, you could almost turn around in the street without backing.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved it because it was so cute and unpowerful and good gas mileage. Why'd you look at me like that? You gave me this look when I said cute. You're like, Geo Prism.
Hey, Pat and Ian, what's up? This is Josh again, and I got another friend who's question.
Hey, Josh.
So I was just in Connecticut for my buddy's wedding, and I saw a lot of friendlies, but I saw one friendlies that had a drive-thru. Have you guys ever seen a friendlies or been to the friendlies that has the drive-thru? I thought it was crazy. Thanks, guys.
I think the one in my, I think there was one in my hometown that had a drive-thru, or maybe not a drive-thru, but a separate walk-up window for ice cream. I think that's actually what I'm remembering. I think there's a separate walk-up window for ice cream.
I don't remember any drive-thru.
Sorry, guys, if I sound a bit off. I'm fighting a nasty cold. This is Duffy from Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville.
Ian, someone recently got a copy of Yokoi Kids Annual 1. I'm only halfway through, but it's fantastic. Are there plans to do a second volume? Pat.
You want to answer that first before he sniffs?
So I hope you feel better or are feeling better. Will there be a volume 2? Honestly, I have no idea. I have a feeling we will get to one at some point. Yokoi Kids is still going on. But it was a lot of work for Rick. And the only money we took back from it was printing costs. It was a charity zine. I think we'll probably do it again. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was a charity zine. But I think it's probably a little ways off.
Excuse me.
Hey, Duffy, you want to be found murdered in a toilet in an airport like that old guy was? I mean, like I wanted to.
If you had to pick a classic 80s movie to get a sequel that never did, what would it be and why?
I always wanted the Goonies to have a sequel, but I mean, they're too late to even almost have kids. They're getting up there.
Yeah.
The Goonies should have had a sequel about 10, 15 years ago with Richard Donner. And they thought about it, and I think they had a script at some point.
It was one of those things that, especially on early internet, always seemed to be rumored, but never came to fruition.
No, there should have been a Goonies sequel like 2010. There should have been.
Hey, Pat. Hey, Ian. This is Max calling from Madison, New Jersey. My parents got me Ape Escape 2 as a kid because they thought catching monkeys would be funny and very kid-friendly, and it definitely was. However, it took me until this past August to finally beat the game because my peanut-sized brain could not figure out how to progress. So I just wanted to know if there were any games that were similar to that for you guys, games that took a long time to beat, or games that were just shelved for too long. Thanks, guys.
What game that took you a while to beat that you came back to at a later time?
I can't really think of any, honestly.
Punch-Out for me, for sure.
Punch out for you.
I couldn't beat Mike Tyson forever.
Sure. At Contra, I got way better at Contra as I entered my teenage years. Yeah, when I, like, growing up, I was not very good
at it. Even with the Konami code?
I mean, I'm talking about actually playing.
Just without it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That was, like, late teens for me where I finally, like, got that down.
I was always good at Ninja Gaiden, but it's that last freaking stage. It was insane. So that was always tough as a kid for me. But Ninja Gaiden is weird because, like, it goes from... It's always difficult, but then that last stage just it ups it so much that you really have to be like play perfectly at some parts to get through it, and that's what makes it so frustrating.
I guess I could say beat 'em ups as a genre in general that I got better at with age, because as a kid I just I didn't play them with any strategy. I just walked up to enemies and started punching on them.
Sure.
Hey Pat and Ian, it's Patrick from Elgin, Illinois.
Hey Pat,
my question is for Pat regarding your thoughts on the Lethal Weapon sequels. Plus, a little trivia for you. The actor who played the main villain in Lethal Weapon 3 is the same actor who played the villain in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3. Oh, really? Thanks, guys.
I never saw Turtles 3. Lethal Weapon 2 is really good. Then 3 is bad. Or at least where I remember 3, I haven't seen 3 in forever. 3 is a real drop off from 2. Because the idea was, I guess, getting old at that point.
Sure.
And then 4 was like, from what I remember, 4 would be, was decent, and it was a good send off to the series. It kind of tied up things, and then, you know, what's his name? Murphy becomes a, what's his name? Not Murphy. What's Danny Glover's name?
Murphy is fucking RoboCop.
Yeah, what's Dan, I'm thinking of Lethal Weapon times RoboCop, which is a whole different series. Yeah, he gets, his daughter is going to have a kid, so it's going to be a grandfather. So it kind of ties up the series. And then Mel Gibson, Riggs is going to have a kid with, what's her name from the third one. So there's some tie, it ties up the series. Pretty nice. So I remember 3 being totally forgettable. I think they wrote it as it went. I read that they were literally writing it as they went, which is not good at all to do that. But 2 is like the, 2, 1 and 2 are great. Like 1 and 2 back to back are great, to watch. You get crazy ass Gary Busey in the first one. It was like terrifying. As a villain for
love watching Gary Busey.
You see, for first Lethal Weapon,
I've never
recently
seen any of them. We talked about this the other week.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
They put a flame under his arm, and the ones I think really did it because he's like, there's a flame under some guy's arm, and he's just taking the pain. It's like, I think
he's crazy.
They might have actually done that with him.
Hello, Pat and Ian. Hey. This is Noah from Maryland. First time, long time. I would like to know what your thoughts are on the continued indefinite delay of Advance Wars Reboot Camp due to the war in Ukraine. As of the day I am recording this, it has been 6 months since Russia invaded Ukraine, and unfortunately, the war does not seem like it will end anytime soon. Do you think it still makes sense to indefinitely delay Advance Wars, which was intended to come out on April 8th because of this war? Do you think is fair to the folks that we...
That's you, Ian. It's not me.
Oh. The fuck?
That was not me. You're looking at me. The hell was that?
I had left my cursor over an ad, and it started playing with audio.
War. Do you think it is fair to the folks at WayForward that they will not be able to make money from the sales of this game for the foreseeable future?
I think I can see delaying it when it was because the war was hitting right when it was supposed to come out back earlier this year, like it was like early March whenever it was supposed to come out. I see that. I think at some point though, you have to realize that this game has to come out.
This is Nintendo being Nintendo. Yeah. I mean, plenty of war games have come out. You know, Modern Warfare 2 is in its beta. You know, I don't love the theme of war for games, but at the same point in time, I think people know the difference between fantasy and reality. And Advanced Wars is played off as extremely cartoony.
It's a cute war game that Nintendo. It's a kiddie Nintendo war game.
So Nintendo needs to get over it and. I think it should come out probably this year.
I think if they delayed it for a month or two, it'd be like, okay, fine. You know, that's fine. Be sensitive. But like,
it's literally finished.
There's always going to be conflicts, unfortunately, all around the world.
Doesn't look like they have a lot of stuff coming out this Christmas, though, so maybe it would be a good time to launch that.
Yeah. I was looking forward to it. I like the Advance War games.
I love them.
Do a few more.
Hey, Pat and Ian. This is Ryan from South Carolina. Love the show. This is a football question. Pat, since you're a Giants fan, and Ian, since you're a Bills fan, Ian, how do you feel about the Giants taking most of the staff from the Bills? And in turn, Pat, do you think that the Bills staff will be able to turn this thing around? Love the show, guys. Thanks.
No, the Giants at best will make a wild card and get destroyed. I mean, at best. I like watching the Giants play, but it's too early for their team to have turned it around in one season with a new culture they're trying to do there. But Dable's been good. Thanks to the Buffalo.
I'm not particularly upset. You know, people move around all the time. That's just sports. That's football. I do think they could have a positive effect on the Giants. But as you said, I think it's too early. And it really, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to the players on the field.
Very, 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 very locker room type of answer. You take it day to day.
You listen to enough fucking sports announcing, your brain goes to mush and you just start saying words that sound right. I'm not immune to it.
Hey guys, John from Lloydminster, Canada again. I was just wondering if you have any favorite game redemption stories in the style of like how No Man's Sky finally shook out. For me, it's got to be the modern console ports of Doom and Doom 2. They were really shaky when they first came out, but they've fixed the aspect ratio and the music and the graphics and the controls, and now they play pretty well. They even have a curated list of WADs you can add on, like the Final Doom stuff or Romero's Sigil. Thank you.
That's a little bit different just because the original Doom was great, so like it didn't have to redeem itself.
I don't think that's quite the same. I think absolutely No Man's Sky is probably the best example of that. But when you said Redemption, I was going, Redemption game
story. I'll say Redemption game story.
I can tell, we used to go to Putt-Putt, my friends and I, in high school, because we were bored with nothing to do, and we would play the shit out of Colorama. Still probably my favorite Redemption game. It's just roulette for children. That's all it is.
Really? I don't think I ever played that.
There's five colors in a ball, and all the colors are different sizes, and you pick which color it's going to land on, and obviously the smaller spaces give you more tickets. It's not a game.
I've seen non-skill redemption games where like the balls drop or whatever.
There's lots of them.
But they try to make them skill-based in terms of the time. You're talking about literally gambling. It's all chance.
Yeah, it's all chance.
Oof.
There's a button you can hit to slow it down.
Okay.
And stop it. So like there's some.
I was gonna say, I think for legality there has to be some.
There is some influence, but very little.
Ooh, that sounds like a slot machine thing. There were slot machine going back to the Dredge Shore. There were literal.
Oh, yeah.
Slot machine, one-armed bandits to win, but I don't know if kids were prevented, but there was always the old women and old guys in their 60s, 70s playing them. It was so weird because it's you're gambling for tokens to get little stuffed animals back. I do a few more here.
Hey, guys. It's Brian from PA. In a recent episode, you were talking about rather out there pinball titles, and I was wondering, Ian, have you ever played Pinball Quest for the Nintendo?
Yeah.
We love that game. It's so weird and...
Yeah, it's fun. Physics can be a little wonky, but the idea is great. I really like video game pinball, and as I get more into I play pinball multiple days a week now. It's my main hobby. But video game pinball that is video gamey, I love. I love that shit. I have less and less interest in playing like virtual recreations of machines. I'd rather play them, but like Pinball Quest, the Devil's, the Crush series, Demon's Tilt, all of that shit. I love it.
You're like a narrative with your pinball.
Well, it's not even a narrative. I just want it to, I don't want it to try to be the real thing. I want it to be its own thing.
Sure. You want little characters running around doing shit and you hit them and I get it. Stuff you can't do in a real pinball machine.
Exactly.
Hey guys, Sergeant Zombie here. Oh, I know it's been a while. Been busy waging war against humanity. You may have noticed no circuses around lately. That's because, thanks to the zombie army, never liked clowns anyway. They always left a funny taste in your mouth. Just wanted to talk about Vid 331. You guys were talking about kart racers. In Mario Kart, I always liked Toad. He's a fun guy you can play as. I'll see myself out.
Thank you. Thank you, Sergeant Zombie. Keep that fight against humanity going,
yeah,
I guess.
We're happy for you.
I don't know where I'm supposed to go with that. Do one or two more?
Let's do one more.
Want to check in with someone?
Let's check in with someone. I'm happy that we have someone else we can check in on now every once in a while.
Okay.
Hey, Pat. Hey, Ian. It's Voxandra, New Jerseyan refugee. I needed to call in because that attack on Pat was absolutely uncalled for.
Gross.
I don't think any of us should stand for it. I mean, seriously, Gorgonzola? Someone just tossing accusations of cheese-like body odor, as well as stereotyping using an Italian cheese? The grating audacity of someone to try and shred Pat's character. Ian can back up the fact that Pat smells like no such thing, and it is, in fact, a pleasant hint of fresh mozzarella. By the way, did you know I used to get teased by my Connecticut friends for saying Mario? I started pronouncing it Mario since they'd get all up in my ass about saying it wrong. From now on, I'll pronounce Mario as I should, with the new confidence you have given me. And if anyone gives me shit, I can say Pat Contry says you can kiss his mozzarella ass. Mm-hmm. Anyway, on to the purpose of my call. I was practicing Castlevania Bloodlines the other day because I'm not as good as it as I am with Castlevania 3, which made me think of something I wanted to ask you guys. Do you ever want to play...
Sorry, you ran out of...
You ran out of time.
Ran out of runway there, Voxandra. Thanks for saying Mario the proper way on the East Coast, and that, yeah, I smell like mozzarella. I don't smell like Gorgonzola. That'd be a tough one. Is that a Dr. Squatch? Smells Gorgonzola.
That's Gorgonzola sunrise.
Well, this was fun. Are you going to enjoy the rest of your day, Ian?
I got a lot of work to do. I got to go to work, and then I got to record another podcast, and then I got to make dinner. So that's what I'm doing.
We'll do our hangout in a week and a half. I think we'll do it.
Cannot do it this week.
We'll do it on the 8th. I said a week and a half.
Okay, yeah. Next week I should be able to do it.
We'll do it on the 8th or so there. And then I'll be at Retropalooza as well on October 21st and 22nd, something like that. The week after we'll be at Portland, I'll be there.
That'll be fun. All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Bye.